You're listening to Paranormal Portal on Revolver Podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of the Paranormal Portal. I'm your host, Brent Thomas. I am here with you. And not only am I here, but my good friend and co-host, Mr. Don Longbeard, is here. How you doing, Don?
I feel a little topless tonight.
Oh, you look lovely.
Oh, well, thank you.
See, your flowing locks. Yes. No, I'm just kidding. They're not really flowing. They're just locks. But
oh, they're flowing.
Well, good to go, ladies and gentlemen. We had had a little bit of a tight wire getting everything underway here, but it looks like everything is good. Thank God. I was about to stroke out, but
that's nothing new.
I know. I think I pulled it all together. I'm just trying to get the screen set up so we're all set for our guest here.
And I finally got in.
Oh, God bless you. I'm so glad to hear your voice.
Sorry, guys. I don't know what was going wrong.
No, it's fine. It's perfectly fine. As long as you're here, I don't care what happened to get you here. I'm just glad you're here, brother. This is a great honor. Ladies and gentlemen, we are joined tonight, but of course, by a man that needs no introduction, as he's been a part of the Bigfoot movement for decades. And doing research and stuff. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome Mr. James Bobo Faye to the show. So you've been around this for decades, though. I mean, you've been all over the world researching the Bigfoot phenomena, and a lot of people think, well, you were just part of Finding Bigfoot, but you were doing shows before that as well.
Yeah, actually, I think my first national thing for finding for Bigfoot was in 1991 when I was in college. I hooked up with these old Bigfoot researcher guys. No one really knows who they are anymore, but they were around in the 50s and 60s. Uh-huh. And I hooked up with them back in like the late 80s. And they definitely knew their stuff. And anyways, I was on a NBC National News with those guys. And that was almost 30 years ago.
Wow. Yep. So, you know, I guess with the stories like this, and I'm sure you've told it about a million times, so forgive me for going over the same road you've been down before, but I just got to know, how did this all start for you? Where did you get into this groove of Bigfoot and deciding to dedicate your life to this research?
It was pretty unlikely. I was a total city guy living down in Southern California. Mm-hmm. My dad took us out to the woods a lot. Like we camped a lot, went up in the mountains and deserts, but I was like a surfer skate kid from down on the coast. Uh-huh. But I just saw the Patterson Gimlin film when I was about five and just got totally hooked on it.
That thing is just crazy. I think that was my first exposure personally to Bigfoot. I think was on In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy, and I think they played that clip on there, and it was like, wow. I didn't know what to do with it, you know, but I was pretty little. Quite honestly, one of the things that shocked me in learning about this stuff was that it's not just in the Pacific, you know, Northwest. It's not just there, because that's where Leonard Nimoy said it was. And
right.
And then I start to find out that they're everywhere, and it really boggles my mind that these beings, for I don't want to say creatures, I don't want to say, you know, whatever, I like to say beings, because I think they're smart. I think they're like nearly us smarter in our neighborhood, but they have to be the most adaptable species on the planet Earth, because they're found in every ecosystem, in every part, every terrain, you know, you name it. And they're not only surviving, but they seem to be thriving.
Yeah, rats, humans, cockroaches, and Sasquatches are pretty adaptable.
I don't know if I'd put us there, other than the fact that we can create our comfort everywhere. But these other things actually do manage to make it work. So, I know I saw you on a show long before Finding Bigfoot came along, and you had just mentioned it before I had unmuted the audio so everyone else could hear. But what other shows did you do?
I did a PBS show with what was his name? Scott Hastings, I think. He shot the Klamath video.
Oh, okay.
Did that, and then I did a World's Scariest Destination, or Top 10 Scariest Places in North America on Travel Channel, I think it was.
Uh-huh.
I did Bigfoot Pacific Northwest. Did some Outdoor Life Network with the Mysterious, that was Mysterious Encounters.
Okay.
That was Doug Hychek from Monster Quest. That was his show previous to Monster Quest.
And I think that's where I caught you initially, was on there. But anyway, continue. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, no. Just like, I can't remember them all now, but just like one-offs, you know, like just, it was some show just doing a thing on Bigfoot, and they'd call me.
Mm-hmm. So was it a big, just a luck of the draw that you somehow ended up in the middle of this incredible series that had seasons and seasons and got to travel the world? Or is there a lot that goes into that?
Well, I definitely had done my homework and, you know, put in my time on the subject, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, it was definitely lucky to get involved with that. It just kind of all fell into our laps. I just got through to get my certification to be an electrician. You know, I took all the classes to be contractor and all that. I was going to take a job at the mill, the lumber mill right next to where I live, and be one of the electricians. And they're like, because I had TV people calling me all the time saying, hey, we got to do a show at the end. They always tried to just rip you off. You know, it was always just BS. Like MTV2 wanted me to do a show back in like, 2000, somewhere around there, 2002.
Uh-huh.
But it was like, I was going to be the host, producer, writer, do everything. And I think at the end of the year, I would have made $14,000 for working all year.
Wow.
And you didn't take it? Wow, that's not even worth getting out of bed for, huh?
No.
Man. Well, I mean, it's still be doing what I wanted to do and getting paid to do what I love, which I would have done. Mm-hmm. Except for the fact that they were all making so much money back then, especially on TV, that it's like, man, I'm not going to get ripped off.
There's a lot of
you guys are.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, just while those guys are getting fat and I'm starving, I was like, fuck that. I mean, screw that.
That's all right. I think there seems to be a lot of that going on out there. I mean, I don't pretend to know too much about that. I've heard other people that are in the business talk about that and how you've got to be real careful because there are so many people that are trying to rip you off and take away your rights to, you know, whatever it is. But I got to tell you that I think, you know, I know there was a lot of people doing Bigfoot stuff through the years, but I really think that your show, the Finding Bigfoot show, was probably the one show that really made Bigfoot a part of our national discussion, like having it out there. And I think that people were surprised at how many people enjoyed the show, because I don't know if you guys knew up front how well it would do, but it's just like, you know, seeing you guys traveling around, seeing you at these town halls all over the place and people coming out of the woodwork with these experiences and stuff. And it's, was that a pretty sobering experience to see that there were so many people out there that were interested in this phenomena?
No, I knew it was there. Like I knew forever that if there was a Bigfoot show, it'd be a hit no matter what, just because Bigfoot's popular.
Yeah.
And they always did well. Like whenever, even those one-offs, the Bigfoots always scored really high. Mm-hmm. And I was just kind of wondering what took them so long to get it really going.
Sure. Well, I think it was probably had to, you know, find the right chemistry too. And you guys definitely had that. It must have been pretty interesting. But I got to ask you this question because it's one I've always been dying for. What's it like to go through thick brush with about 80 pounds of cameras pointing at your face and stuff?
Dude, it sucks so bad. I hate those things. It's the arm hanging off with the light and the camera at the end of it. Like it just, every bush that you're pushing through catches on that, then lets go and smacks you in the face, you know, as you go through. Or they're always getting knocked around, or they're in your way when you're trying to therm. And I just can't stand it. I'm sure someday I'll have to put one on again, but I sure hope not.
I always wondered, because when I was watching the show, I mean, it was fine to see you guys, but it was like so much of the show would be like you guys making faces. And I'm like, what are you looking at? What do you see? What are you hearing? You
know? Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. And then they'd play some stupid, like spooky music over like the sounds we're listening to.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Did you guys have any control of the editing, or was that all out of your
control? No, just through total complaining.
And how many seasons did that go for?
They said 10, but it was probably really like 8 or 9, because the last couple of seasons were like 4 and 6 or something, whereas earlier seasons had been like 14 episodes.
Yeah. I noticed that trend is happening more and more where they're calling it a season, but it's like, God, I remember when I was a kid, seasons took like all the way from fall until the late spring.
Now
it's like a weekend is a season on TV.
Yeah, it's because they're so afraid to commit any resources long-term. Before they'd order, like, you know, 2 years worth of episodes, and now, like, you'll get an order for 4 to 6. Like, that's the last few years we were working, like, that's what we got orders on, was usually, like, just a half dozen or something at a time, because they just do not want to commit to anything, because the money's so tight. I mean, say, like, just for instance, this was an art show, but just a TV show in the year 2000, say it was $100,000 for a 30-second commercial. When we started finding Bigfoot in 2010, it was down to like $40,000. Now it's down to about probably $15,000. That's how much revenue's dropped. Like as streaming gets more and more popular, the budgets for television just shrink and shrink and shrink.
Right. Wow, that's huge. I didn't realize it was so huge. But
yeah, and even like Netflix and Amazon, like that were making just hand over fist. They, you know, were just throwing money out, like giving out huge contracts for this and that and that. And it's even hitting those guys.
Wow. Because of like YouTube and people just streaming their own things, do you think? Or it's just.
Yeah, bootleg piracy and just people resharing and stuff, like reposting stuff, links.
Oh, that hurts, huh?
I mean, I get it, but yeah, it's like someone's got to pay somewhere down the line, or nothing's going to get made.
Right, right. And now that it's in syndication still, right? I mean, there's still times where you'll catch Finding Bigfoot on Animal Planet or other channels as well, right?
Oh, it still airs on Animal Planet, Discovery, Destination America, and Travel Channel. Then all those channels, international channels, also.
Hmm.
Like, we're still first run in a lot of places.
Oh, I can believe
it. They haven't gone through all the episodes yet.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like over in parts like East Europe and Africa.
Do you guys ever go over there to do promotionals for that at all, or do they not do that anymore?
No, they don't do that. Yeah, I mean, like I was saying, if this was in the 80s or the 90s, we would have for sure. But in the 2000s, things have just changed more and more and more. So, like, there's less and less of that stuff.
Wow. So before you got on the Finding Bigfoot, I know you and Cliff had already been friends for quite a while before that. But did you already know like Matt and Renee and other people involved, or is this all new?
I was in touch with Matt a little bit on and off over the years from about 98. And he just, you know, farmed me out to someone else that was in the group, the BFRO back then. And then I didn't meet him in person until we were filming Mysterious Encounters, and they hired me to be, I was just like the local unit producer, like local producer, fixer guy. That's, I was doing gigs like that for TV shows up here that would come up just for whatever thing. But mainly they wanted to film Bigfoot stuff because I was the only guy that knew where the Patterson-Gimlin film site was and how to get in there.
Oh, cool.
So I'd get hired for that, and then I'd hang out, like we'd be hanging out, and they'd always be like, dude, you got to be in front of the camera. I'm like, nah, I'm cool. It's just a little job on the side. And then they kept trying to get me to do stuff, And then I just did a few one-offs, and then nothing came together until finally finding Bigfoot, like where it was, you know, like it was people I knew already. And it seemed like, you know, like, which can be pretty legit for the most part.
Mm-hmm. And that was that really built around the BFRO as kind of the foundation for that? Or was that just incidental?
It was the way they found me. Well, they knew about me because I had just done the show with Bob. Oh, yeah, I did that strange. I don't know if you saw that Bob Saget show.
No, Strange Days.
That was pretty funny. Yeah, actually, that's what really got it popping was I had four show offers after that from four different networks. And Discovery had already started working with Ping Pong Productions, which was Josh Gates's company that he was working for. Mm-hmm. So, they'd already had the ball rolling with that whole thing. And they were looking at act. They'd already made, a couple pilots with actors because Josh Gates was an actor. He wasn't like an explorer or nothing like that.
Sure.
So they tried to do the same route like they did with Josh Gates for our show. And it just didn't work at all because they didn't know anything about Bigfoot. Like it wasn't natural. They gave him like, you know, it was like writers that didn't know anything about Bigfoot writing dialogue for actors that didn't know anything about Bigfoot. So if you knew anything about Bigfoot, it just sounded totally wrong. Or even if you didn't know, it sounded wrong. So they wanted to get real people, and they got a hold of me. And then I told them about Cliff, and they said, yeah, we know about Cliff. We saw him on his YouTube thing. And then I told them about Matt, and surprised those people didn't know about Matt.
Yeah.
But which shocked me because he was like, at that point, had been on more Bigfoot stuff than anybody, and, you know, being the BFRO head and all that.
Right.
So then Wally, the guy that was the funder for the BFRO back then, he was the money guy. He lived right by Matt in Southern California, so they just arranged for it all. Wally had everyone get together at their house, and the Discovery talent came out, and they invited the 10 finalists for the show, and we all got together, and then, God, it was months later, they picked Matt, Cliff, and myself, and then they couldn't find a female forever. It took months and months and months, and Matt was pushing Renee really hard. I only met her once, briefly.
Sure.
And all the other women we had that were lined up for it were because they're real leery. They're real careful about the women they hire because they do not want to get into a potential, you know, mom pregnancy situation.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Especially for like a travel show, you know.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So they wanted to get a woman that was, you know, already kind of more not like 20-something that might just go off and have a kid. So we had the women that were available were, you know, mostly in their mid-20s. We were like in our early 40s, and they thought it just looked too creepy having someone that wasn't our own age. So they finally settled on, after months, they finally settled on Renee.
Oh, okay. Well, that was kind of, you know, that's kind of cool, though, because she added quite an interesting dynamic to the show. Most of the time I was yelling at the TV, like, what are you talking about, Renee? That's definitely a Squatch.
We were doing the same thing.
Were you really? Yeah, it was like sometimes it was just like she was so contrary, even when it didn't seem like there was. I mean, she would just fabricate sometimes, like, oh my God, woman, what are you seeing? But you know,
I know, dude. Yeah, she was in a tough. It was when she, those utter fabrications, that's what would really make me mad. And she would never admit she was wrong. You know?
I'm a married man. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. But I mean, in her defense, I mean, she showed up every day for work for like 8.5 years.
Yeah.
And put up with us the whole time. But her job was to represent the viewers at home. Because when the show started, 70% of our audience didn't believe in Bigfoot. They just watched it because they liked the cast and the travel aspects of it. It was like a travel show to them.
Right, right.
And by the time when the show ended, it was like high 60-something% of the people that watched it believed Bigfoot was real.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean. But you guys definitely created the ability to have this discussion. I mean, you know, it didn't, obviously there was people that were into this prior to that, but I think it was still kind of relegated to, you know, just whispering among friends. You didn't want to say it too loud because then you'd be that guy or something. But as soon as your guys' show came out, it was like, suddenly it kind of became cool. And people really did start having the discussions like, hey, I saw this on TV. What did you think of that? And it would be this, you know, this dialogue that just started taking form and shape, and it became part of our social consciousness. And I think that's largely due to what you guys did.
Yeah, it was definitely part of it. For sure. It was like the impetus, because it was crazy as you hear about like Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul and these other Republican members of Congress would have the Bigfoot Monday morning breakfast club, and they discuss finding Bigfoot and the witnesses they saw on the show. Because Mitch McConnell's a 2-time Bigfoot witness, and Rand Paul's a 1-time witness.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Cool. They won't go public with it.
Well, you can hardly blame them.
they're the lowest. I think those guys were around 10% approval rating, so it couldn't hurt. I'm thinking like, God, you know. It can only help at this point. Who doesn't want to be seen with Bigfoot?
I think you're right. I think actually that could help their numbers. Okay, everybody. I think it's time we got to take a break. So don't go away, and we'll be right back with more of the Paranormal Portal podcast in just a couple minutes. Hey guys, Brent Thomas here, the Paranormal Portal Podcast. We just wanted to take a moment to introduce you to the Paranormal Portal store. We've got t-shirts, hoodies, leggings, stickers, mugs, you name it, you might find it over there. So head on over to teespring.com/stores/paranormal-portal, and you too can help fund the Paranormal Portal Podcast. Thank you so much for all that you do, and thank you for being a part of our Paranormal Portal family. Everybody, and we're back at it here on the Paranormal Portal Podcast. Buckle up, we're going in. Looking at the Bigfoot community in our country especially, but around the world, I mean, people are just really, I mean, this is the most involved community of all the paranormal that I've been experiencing in doing the shows. It's like we do ghost shows, you know, we get some participation and stuff. We do UFO shows, get some participation. But when we do Bigfoot shows, man, people are coming out of the woodwork. It's like, wow, it's really been an eye-opener for me because, you know, I love all of it, but I just am always fascinated with how dedicated the Bigfoot audiences are. Like they will look and find shows because they want to know, they want to learn. They're just this ravenous, hungry for more information.
Yeah, I think. Well, I know that ghosts is way more popular. Just you can look at all the shows that were made, how many of there have been, and the size of their conferences versus the size of our conferences. But yeah, I mean, just since our show came out, the Bigfoot conferences have swelled. I mean, there's way more of them, and they're way bigger. Because prior to that, if you went to a Bigfoot conference, there was 300 people there. It was like a big deal. There's only a couple in the country that did that, like Ohio and. Yeah. Really, Ohio and Texas were the only two that did more than like 200.
Wow. Yeah.
Now they do thousands.
Now there's like every town almost has a Bigfoot conference. But I think, I think it is growing. I think it is growing even to almost challenge the ghost thing because, you know, I haven't seen that much reaction for our shows. Now, you know, when we first started doing the show, we fell in, you know, by the grace of you know, people like Wes Germer came on and was a big part of it. We had Bear come on and he was on our show several times and that really helped to establish us, I think, with the Bigfoot community. But I have
Bear Grylls?
No, Jim Bear King, the Bigfoot Outlaw. Jim King.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah, he's been on here a few times, and a great guy. I love talking to him. But, you know, those things really, I think, maybe gave us some street cred right off the bat. But I do love how interested in the Bigfoot community is for this information. We had a question in our chat, Bobo. What was the favorite place that you guys ever filmed shows at? Was there one location that really stood out for you?
Well, there's kind of a couple factors. That there's like, where was there great squashing? Like, what was the best place we went? Because it was just so rad that we were getting Bigfoot action. Or there's the overall experience of being like just in an awesome place. I mean, like Nepal and the Himalayas was insanely beautiful and just such a once in a lifetime opportunity, you know, to go fly up into the Himalayas and go to Pingboche and those kind of places. I mean, so it's hard to say we loved everywhere we went. We could say internationally, the least fun was Indonesia just because it was so rugged and rough and terrible food and all that kind of stuff, but it was still rad. I mean, way stoked. I mean, I liked it more than everyone else. But we all agreed the only place we just really had a lame time was Kansas.
Flatland.
But it was like that Arctic vortex. It was like January.
Oh,
you know, it never got above 20 degrees. The wind never dropped below 20 miles an hour from the north. There was it's just real thin trying to find any squatch action in that place, especially that time of the year. So it was kind of a waste of time the whole time we were there, and we just froze the whole time.
Man.
But the people were cool.
People
in the Midwest, they are the nicest people in the country for sure.
What?
We're in the north of Idaho, so Don, Don apparently disagrees, but no. Yeah. I suppose I should introduce you. Don is my co-host, Don Longbeard, and I never did introduce you guys, so sorry about that.
How you doing, Bobo?
Good. How you doing, Don?
You know, I just sit back and listen and laugh and interject every now and then, so I'm doing fine. Thank you. I don't got to drive the bus.
He doesn't have to drive the bus.
But Northwest Idaho, that's not Midwest. That's the West.
Yeah, we're up in the I think I call it the Pacific Inland Northwest or something.
Inland Pacific Northwest. Yeah, I just know a lot of Midwesterners apparently.
I'm a Minnesota transplant myself, so I think you're right, Bobo.
Oh, Minnesota, yeah, they're way nice people.
Yeah, represent, brother.
Are you a T-Wolves fan?
You know, I liked them. I was never much for basketball, but, you know, I thought it was kind of cool when they, you know, because Minnesota's actually where the Lakers used to be, you know, that way back in the day.
Yeah.
And so we lost them, and that was before my time, but I thought it was cool that we got another team, you know. But
I know. You're talking about people, like, surprised about people that are into the show. The director of media relations for the T-Wolves is a huge fan, and I got to be friends with him. I just spoke to him the other day.
Oh, nice.
Jeff Municki.
Uh-huh. That's really cool.
Yeah, like the head football coach and the athletic director for University of Minnesota are huge Bigfoot fans too. So like you just hear about like these you hear about different people like that are like, oh, that guy's like Dave Navarro from the guitar player. Yeah. Like
he's a Bigfoot.
Yeah, he's super into it. Oh, like you just hear like random reports like that. Like, hey, this guy's a huge fan of yours, like Yoko Ono.
Are you serious?
Yeah, he just hear like these, yeah.
Oh no.
Oh no, it's Yoko. No, that's cool. I mean, I suppose, but you know, for the most part, that's probably the only place they would admit it is just through a mutual friend, because for the same reasons, I think that as far as this discussion has come, I don't think people are quite willing to, you know, wear the t-shirts. Not everybody anyway,
right.
You know, or have the bumper stickers. Yeah. But it's getting there.
I'm surprised. Yeah, it's way more than it used to. That's like, there's people are at least willing to talk about it now, like a semi-serious tone, but it's still something you don't want to go admitting if you're worried about your reputation at all.
Yeah. Well, it's still kind of akin to fairies and dragons and things like that in a lot of people's minds. But I got to say, I don't think there's any arguing when you look at the whole body of evidence. I don't know how anybody that's sane can just discard it and go, well, that's nothing. There's nothing there. You know, I don't understand how people can discard that, because with the hundreds or thousands of prints and tracks, with the hair samples that have been out there, some of the genetic studies, and then anecdotal witnesses, people that have had experiences. I mean, how do you dismiss all of that?
It's very, it takes a special kind of stupid, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. But once you get through the looking at the glass and you start going in and looking at all that makes up this field, there have been a lot of incredible people dedicating their lives, their blood, sweat, and tears to looking into this phenomenon. And they found some amazing things, you know. And it's frustrating because there'll always be those people that just, like, no matter what, as long as it's not scientifically endorsed, it's just like there's nothing there. They like their paradigms, right, you know. But I think as soon as people really take a serious look at all of the information and information and evidences there are out there, it's got to be something. Because, you know, I think about things, Bobo, about, like, you go to a remote place, and I know you've researched all over the world, all over the country, I'm sure you've been to some places that may have never even seen human feet before. And then you know, to have a chance encounter with some huge track, you know, I mean, who the hell's going to hoax way out there? You know, how does that make sense to anybody?
It does. You're going to find very, very, very few well-informed skeptics of Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too. And that's the frustrating part. But like I said, I think you guys have made some great inroads to changing a lot of people's minds, and then also making it okay for the people that do believe to have the discussion, as I was saying before. And that's largely due to what you guys are doing. Now, is there any possibility that finding Bigfoot will ever begin again?
I think so.
Good.
I mean, they've been talking. I think we would have already started if it wasn't for the COVID.
Oh, sweet. Oh, it's that.
Because I know, because they would, every once in a while, I get a message saying, wow, you guys are killing it, like on the Go apps, like the streaming on demand stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We never finished more than top three. We never finished out of the top three for all the shows we've ever had that are available on streaming, like, plus all the new shows that are first run. We beat all of them all the time. So.
Okay, everybody, I think it's time we got to take a break, so don't go away, and we'll be right back with more of the Paranormal Portal podcast in just a couple minutes. All right, everybody, and we're back, at it here on the Paranormal Portal podcast. Buckle up. We're going in. So what was the location that had the best information or the best experiences for you guys in terms of Bigfoot?
Internationally, it was definitely Australia.
Okay.
I think that's the only place we had action outside of the country, I'm pretty sure.
Now, that's the one where you actually heard the samurai chatter, right?
Yeah. That was a crazy one. It just sounds fake. Like, I mean, to hear the story, how it all came about and how just the chain of events that led to that night. But I guess this is a 2-hour show, right?
We got all kinds of time, brother. Keep going. All the time you need.
Keep going.
Well, I was actually over in Hawaii on Oahu. I used to go there every year for the wintertime. Go surf and hang out with my friends and stuff and watch the contest. I don't know if you guys ever heard of the Pipeline Masters.
Yeah. Oh, the surfing contest?
Bonsai Pipeline. Mm-hmm. It's the greatest show on earth. It's awesome. I mean, it breaks right on shore, really close to shore. It's, you know, it can kill you. It's a gnarly wave. And you're just sitting there like, it's like sitting in the owner's box at the 50-yard line at the Super Bowl. You're just right. There's not a bad seat in the house. You're just sitting there watching these guys get the craziest waves. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's bikini models on the beach. You know, it's just a full scene.
Wow. Sure.
And I used to get hooked up through Volcom. They're a clothing brand, like action sports stuff.
Right.
And like Quiksilver, Billabong, all the big brands, Hurley, they all got their... They all own houses right at Pipeline, and like the company house, and they have like the team riders and stuff there. And they're you know, it's like just big parties.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd stay at the Volcom house, and this guy, Makua Rothman, who's a really well-known big wave surfer, local Hawaiian kid. And he showed up with this guy, and to get in the Volcom house is kind of, it's pretty much a VIP affair. Like, you're not just getting in. And he brought this big Samoan looking guy or something in with him, or like Maori or Tongan or something, big guy. And he brought him in, and they were sitting out there, and then Makua left him, and it started just one of those like Hawaiian style rainstorms that just pop up out of nowhere and just dump for like 20 minutes and stop. One of those blew through, and just, it was kind of cold. It was December, early morning, like 7. And it's cold if you get wet. And this guy got just totally dumped on. He was sitting there, he was limping. He had a, looked like he had a broken ankle almost, but with no crutch or anything. And I was like, God, who is this guy? You know, I mean, Makua brought him. He can't just be some scrub. But he just was sitting out there in like dirty clothes, freezing in the corner. And when I said, what's up, man? I started talking, I could tell he was hungry and stuff. So I went and bought him a breakfast burrito from the Roach Coach outside the gate. And he just wolfed it down. I bought him another one. We started talking. And it turned out he was an Aboriginal, but they call them saltwater Aboriginals because they traded so much and bartered with the Maoris that they bred with the Polynesians. Like, they don't look like the traditional, like, inland, really dark, dark, you know, typical Aboriginal look. What do you think of an Aboriginal, like that kind of look? These guys look more Polynesian. So I started talking to them. I'm like, no way. I said, you know what? We're thinking about going to Australia for looking for the Yowie. And usually no one knows. Most Australians don't know what a Yowie is. They know it's a candy bar and that's it. Like, literally, 90% of the people in Australia had no idea what a Yowie is when we were there. Okay. At least 90%. So this guy knew about him. I'm like, no way. And you know, he's telling me like, yeah, and blah, blah. And so I got his contact. He's telling me his brothers have seen him a bunch of times. And I got his contact information and talked to him a couple times over the internet, a few times, saying, yeah, hey, what's up, man? Then we found out we were going. So I said, hey, we're coming. He's like, well, maybe you can interview my brothers. And it turned out we were going to be way far, like 10 hours away. We get down there. We were going to film with Rex Gilroy, who's a famous cryptozoologist, like the most famous cryptozoologist in Australia, wrote all the books and stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, he had dementia setting in, and he was kind of losing it. He was just, you know, like in his 80s and dementia and was unusable. And another guy we were working with kind of went kind of nuts and tried to extort the company like a bunch of money to produce the witnesses he had lined up. Oh. And that fell apart. Wow. So I said, hey, well, I got these buddies up 10 hours, 12 hours north of here in the next state up in Queensland. I said, let's go. We were down in New South Wales in Sydney, Blue Mountains. And I said, well, let me go check this out. So I flew up there, went and talked to him and stuff. And that was I can't even get into that part of the story, but
sure.
It was just full serendipity. And we met him and it turned out, you know, his family was, you know, really cool, totally traditional, very, very traditional, like, these guys didn't wear shoes. They didn't go to like regular schools. Mm. They literally lit up the land. Like, the Aboriginals down there made like, you know, like we have Native Americans who live on the res. Like, they'll,
sure,
you know, hunt their own meat and get their own fish and stuff. But they maybe grow some stuff and get some medicinal herbs. But you know, they shop at the store and they, you know, cook, you know, they go to fast food, they go to restaurants, stuff like that. These guys didn't do any of that. The only thing they bought at the store was flour and sugar and couple like literally nothing. They caught and made and just collected all their own food.
Wow.
And his brother turned out, there's 1,080 tribes, different Aboriginal groups in Australia. Wow. And each one of them, what they call, what we call a medicine man, they call a clever fella.
Yep. Yep.
And so they have each one of those 1,080 tribes has their own clever fella. Mm-hmm. And when the Aboriginals, the cultural, whatever their committee, whatever it is, their national body, they get together and they have like a political arm, and then they have the medicine arm, which is the actually more powerful and more respected one. So there's 1,080 representatives from each of those tribes. They break up into 10 sections. So each one of the 10 sections has 108 clever fellows representing the 108 tribes of that section.
Wow.
And those 10 guys, out of those 108, they elect one guy. So it's kind of like the cardinals, you know, for the Catholic Church.
Sure, yeah.
Then those 10 guys, they're the Council of 10. And then there's one that's above them. It's like the Pope, basically, you know, or the Dalai Lama type figure.
Okay.
And his older brother was the guy training to be the next. He'd been 19 years. He started when he was 17. He was 36. And he'd spent 19 years he'd walked around the continent, circumnavigated the whole continent of Australia 2.5 times already, learning from all the top clever fellows around the country, and also how to live and hunt and gather whatever foods are in every part of the whole continent. They knew how to hunt out in the bush, up in the mountains, diving, everything. But he also learned remote viewing and like telepath. Well, you had to have this stuff in you innately.
Sure.
You know, they'd pick you. You got chosen when you were a kid, and they trained you until the guy died. Then you take over. So, I mean, I'm not shitting you, man. I was sitting there watching. We were hanging out, and we were just chilling in the – we went surfing in the morning, and we came back in. We're just chilling at the pad, and this little bird flies in the door and lands on the windowsill next to the brother that's the – you know, training to be the top dog. And he looks at it and nods his head, and he looks at the kids and goes, "Get ready." And there's several houses, the family lives together, and it's on a Aboriginal reserve right on the ocean. And they all gather up real quickly, they gather these nets, and they go out in the water, and he goes, "Yep." And the bird, there's a seagull flies over, and he nods at it and talks to it a little bit. He said, "Yeah, they're coming from the north." And sure enough, you see the water splashing, and he goes, "All right, get in position." The kids get out in the water with the net, and a pod of dolphins is driving a huge school of fish down along the coast, and they herd them into this, like, they make like a U-shape of the net along the beach, and the dolphins herd in the fish and feed, and then the dolphins get out of the way, and they close the net and drag it up on the beach, and they have all their fish there. But, I mean, this guy would talk to animals, like, they like to eat iguanas, you know, like monitor lizards.
Sure.
And there was like a 5-foot one up in the tree, and he points at it. He does like, remember the old Crocodile Dundee where he hypnotizes the bull?
Yeah.
Like, that's real. Those guys do that. He did that to the iguana, and it crawled down the tree, walked right up in front of him, and put its head down, and he carried a club and bashed it over the head. Wow. And we just cooked it.
Oh, my God.
Like, yeah, he could remote view. Oh, that's the other thing, is that he'd get calls. Well, he didn't carry a phone, but his brother would get calls. Uh-huh. He'd be like, he'd talk to his brother, and he'd say, "So-and-so is going on walkabout for Dreamtime up in Northern Territories. He wants to know if he walks out to such and such falls. Is the creek spring, is that dry this year? Because they're having terrible droughts." Mm. And he would close his eyes for about 30 seconds, and he'd go see if there's water or not. And he looked. He could look anywhere on the continent, anywhere in the world, really. But sure, he would just look for the Aboriginals doing Dreamtime walks and the walkabouts. He would guide them where to go for water. Like, and he was 100% on. And wow. I mean, I was around him for a couple of weeks and just saw.
Yeah.
And he's the one that talked to the. He was talking to the Yowies about if we could see him or not or film him. Mm-hmm. And. He took me out to a spot where I heard him. I didn't see him, but I heard him in daylight. This pretty crazy place had a crop of waterfall, like the side of a waterfall. And it was pretty out there. It was a pretty deep spot. And these guys, it was crazy thing was these guys were fearless around, like great white sharks, tiger sharks, blah, blah. Big, you know, gnarly people have some big gnarly dogs down there, like Rottweiler stuff. And they're not afraid of anything, but When they heard, they weren't even so much afraid of the Yowies as the brown jacks, the little ones, little 3 to 4 foot tall ones, 5 foot tall ones.
Okay.
They were scared to death of those ones.
Really?
Yeah. And it sounds like we were wondering if maybe they could, some of them, well, we think there was two things they called brown jacks, possibly. One could be the Homo floresiensis, like the hobbit people from the Isle of Flores that they discovered a couple of years ago.
Yeah, in Indonesia, yeah.
Yeah, they think those might still be alive, actually. Like Dr. Meldrum's looked into that. There's reports of basically describing those things from the north of Australia and also up in the islands up and through there where they were discovered. They still get reports of those things. And then there's also something that seems to be like they're not the same thing as a Yowie, which is just a Bigfoot, but they're similar and smaller and way more aggressive and like kind of crazy.
Wow. Kind of like the Albata witches here, or, you know, what people call, I don't know if that's the right name, but they're supposedly, well, it could be a Pukwudgie too, kind of thing. Are you familiar with those?
Up in Alaska?
Yeah, well, actually, they're supposed to be all over, as far as we understand it, but You know, you wonder, because they're apparently supposed to be really nasty bastards, too. So I don't know what it is. They got the small man complex going on in the, these little cryptids. But, you know, I was, when you were talking about the Homo floresiensis, the hobbit people, I was instantly thinking about that video that came out of Indonesia, those guys riding motorcycles mm-hmm. through the jungle area. Have you seen that one, Bobo?
Yeah, we were down there right after that was taken. Oof. And that's actually a tribe of humans, of little pygmy humans that live down there. And our guides were familiar, knew some of them, actually personally knew some of the people from that tribe. They said, yeah, it's just, they're human beings. They're just small.
Okay. So are they considered acknowledged, or are they more of a supernatural, not supernatural in meaning that they have special powers, but, you know, when we think of like gnomes. There's many cultures that believe that those are, you know, another form of human, but they're different. There's other things like that. So are these considered more of a paranormal type of human, or are they a normal human?
No, they're like the pygmies from the Kalahari or something. You know, they're
okay.
Just adults are like 4 to 5 feet tall.
Huh. Yeah, whatever this one was. It looked like it was about 3 feet tall, but I guess it could be more of a juvenile thing. But right. Man, I was thinking, is that one of the Hobbit people? You know,
they said it was basically kind of like one of their uncontacted tribes, but they're contacted. They're just
okay.
They just stay out in the bush.
Well, I can't blame them.
Yeah, smart.
So it was through that you had the experience with the samurai chatter.
Oh yeah, well I believe he was in contact with these things, and he was saying he was trying to talk them into showing themselves so we could film, because they were saying these things are constantly complaining about people tearing up their environment, tearing up their homes.
Oh yeah,
because mining's out of control down in Australia.
Oh sure,
it's huge. I think it's nearly 50% of all the world's deposits needed for computers and cell phones comes out of Australia.
Oh, really? Oh, that's
yeah. Like all those little weird metals and minerals.
Okay, I guess that doesn't surprise me.
So he was talking to him, supposedly, you know, through telepathy, saying, you know, like they said, no, we can't show ourselves. It's the end of the world, which is weird. Which is powerful medicine men I've known and women out here on the West Coast. I said the same thing when they talked with Sasquatch. They said, it's like the Book of Revelations will be fulfilled if they come out. Like which was interesting hearing totally unrelated Aboriginals in Australia saying the same things as Canadian and U.S. Native Americans have said. It was interesting. They said no. Then I said, well, can we at least hear them? Can we at least hear them talk? And he said, yeah, they can do that. But then the next day after that all happened, where we heard it but didn't record it, he talked to them again, and they said, he said, hear us talk. He didn't say record them talk.
Oh, you got to be more specific.
Yeah, you got to be real. You know, it's funny. It's people that I don't buy most of these people that say they're telepathic, you know, having telepathic conversations with Bigfoot. I think almost all of them are full of it to a large degree.
Yeah,
but the ones that are real seem to, like I always say, like when you make requests of the Sasquatch, it's kind of like a wordplay game to them or something. Like they're like Tom Powell, when they were asking, he's working on a project in Oregon back like late 90s, early 2000s. He was telling the medium, saying, can you get us a bone? You know, bring us a bone, because they wouldn't. He wanted proof. Like, can you bring, you know, part of a dead one? So they dropped off a bone, but it was the breastplate of like an emu.
Oh,
Like a, you know, a large domestic emu.
Yep.
And it came from, there was a farm a couple miles away, an emu farm, but then when the psychic contacted the Sasquatches that were supposed to have done that. They said, you said a bone. You didn't say a Sasquatch bone. You just said a bone. That was a cool looking bone.
That's so funny. Wow. I have an open mind for that. I don't necessarily understand it, but I think telepathy exists not only, you know, between people, but interspecies. I think that it must. And I think that dogs might be a great example of that because, you know, the way that they can cue right into the energy of the person around them. You know, at least it's there's like some kind of serious empathy going on with nature and natural animals and such. Like they can sense things, and you know, it's that sixth sense thing. But you, I mean, obviously, you must have heard about things like the mind speak. What are your thoughts about that? Have you had any experiences of that yourself?
Yeah, and I'm totally down for like the scientific explanations. Like, well, you know, infrasound can cause you to have those, like, hear, like when they've done Department of Defense testing with infrasound, mm-hmm. the subjects reported hallucinatory audio hallucinations. Hearing things like voices, messages, a lot of danger stuff, like get out of here. And it's like maybe your subconscious warning you. It could also be a pheromone or just some kind of scent that causes that reaction. Like when we smell it, since we've evolved next to these things, you know, over millennia, that when we smell it, our basic genetic makeup is to flee. And maybe your mind's telling you, like, your body's reading this chemical reaction and putting it into words in your own head, which you attribute to the Sasquatch, but it's saying, get the hell out of here. But it could just be your own inner self warning. So, but I've had a couple experiences, like Tom Powell was mentioning him in his backyard. Me and Cliff were sleeping back there one night, and he had stuff happened in there. And we'd gone around. We did this. He has a 6-mile loop around his house at night where you walk through the forest, where he goes down by the river and he goes to these spots. We do a couple of calls, and a lot of times they'll come back to his place when it's all said and done, and creep around the woods and behind the house. Mm-hmm. And sorry about that. Oh, shoot. I'm trying to turn off this. Sorry about that noise. I keep getting stuff.
I'm not hearing anything, so it didn't come through the
screen. Oh, you're not? Oh, okay. It's coming through on my end. Okay. All right, good. So I was back there one night, and about 100 yards to the west, I hear this crack branch break, and I just instantly had this image of Sasquatches breaking the branches. Uh-huh. And then I heard one about 50 yards away, about a minute later, another crack, you know, full on purpose branch break. Mm-hmm. And like, I was getting real goosebumpy and stuff. And I was trying to wake Cliff up. Cliff sleeps super sound. He sleeps or anything. Nice. And, I was like, Cliff, get up. And he just kept sleeping real hard. And then I just heard this huge crack just directly in front of me, about 40 feet away in the tree line. And I just got this loud, clear message saying, we're here.
Oof. Wow.
Yeah. And it was like loud and clear. Then my first real, for sure, Bigfoot encounter, like I knew it wasn't. I mean, it turned out in hindsight, when we were logging, I'd been around him a bunch of times and just didn't know it. Because mm-hmm. I didn't know the signs all the way.
Yeah.
And now I look back going, oh my God, like we were right there with him. But the first time I had my real experience in 2001, where there was no doubt what it was. So I had this encounter. I was in a clearing, set up a beach chair, chilling out. It was like late May, warm summer night, 70 degrees. Mm-hmm. And had this crazy encounter. This huge male Sasquatch came into the tree line around the edge of the meadow I was sitting in, and just tearing down trees and roaring and stomping and making by far the craziest sounds I've ever heard. If it would have been recorded, it wasn't as expressive as the vocal, so to speak, talk that you hear in the Sierra sounds.
Sure.
It was a lot of more just roaring and
yikes.
Big giant exhales and lip flaps and growls and grunts and all kinds of stuff. And I had a night, it was the first time I had a real night vision with me. It was a Gen 2 early 90s Ukrainian Gen 2 night scope. Mm-hmm. Passive, you know, didn't have any thermal, it was just night scope.
Okay.
And I had that thing and I was messing with it. It was the first time I ever took it out. And it had four dials on the front that were all kind of, they're all the same. But a couple were like focus. One was, I don't know. I don't even know what it was. It was all written in like Ukrainian writing. But one was a battery cap cover, and I was messing with it, and I was like, "Why's my?" And it was just the battery was dying, and I unscrewed the battery lid too far because I didn't know what it was. And when it just went dead, the second it went dead, there was this huge cry, like a screaming yell cry. And then within a second of that, I got just bluff charged. Well, I didn't know it was a bluff. I thought it was a real charge. Two or three, I think it was three, for sure there was two, came charging out of the tree line across me in the meadow and ran into this little stand of trees I was sitting against. It was like a, if you're driving down this dirt logging road, on your right hand side, it was like a crescent shaped half moon meadow. And in the middle of it, not the middle of the meadow, but the middle of like the half circle, which ran along the road, there was a stand of trees about 60 feet wide and 30 feet thick. And I was sitting on the edge of that facing the meadow. And these things ran behind me. And I thought, well, God, they must have just kept going. I don't hear them now. And I was pretty freaked out because like they, just, I mean, they shook the ground. I mean, it was, and they were so fast and they sounded so giant. And I mean, I'd already heard them snapping trees and stuff. So I knew they were big, and I was antagonizing them, growling, beating my chest and all that stuff. And yeah, not too smart. And I started hearing rustling in the tree line right behind me. And I was sitting in the chair and I'm like, oh my God, that's him. Well, at first I thought it was just a mouse or like a wood. I thought it was a wood rat gathering like nest material at first. And it was so subtle. And then I started getting like, I started realizing it's the big one. It's right behind me. I could, and I started hearing like this deep breathing coming from up high.
Oh God.
Like really high, like higher than the roof. And I was like, oh my, and it's right behind, like within 5 feet of me, behind me to my right shoulder. And I'm like, all right, folks, get it together. Don't get us scared now. You know, you got to, cause I had a, this was like in 2001, I had a disposable 35 millimeter camera, a cardboard camera, remember those disposable cameras?
Yeah.
And it had a flash, and I flicked the flash on. I said, all right, in 10 seconds, I'm going to turn around and snap its picture. It's probably going to smack me or kick me or something, but I just got to hold on. Don't lose the camera. So I was trying to, okay, all right, Bo, now you got to do it. Don't be a wuss. Turn around, take its picture. And right when I started to turn around, I just, this growl comes low, just the deepest grumbly growl. Starts growling, and it hit me like a laser beam. And I was feeling like this wave of energy coming out of it. And I just got this clearest message in my head. It said, if you turn around and take my picture, I'm going to effing kill you, and no one's ever going to find your body.
Oh my God.
It was just loud and clear. Like just, I mean, it wasn't like an audible, like it wasn't like an air, but in my head, it was just the loudest, clearest message I ever got.
Wow. Oh God. Yeah, that'd be horrible.
But that, it could have been pheromone induced, you know, I mean,
sure.
Just me being so nervous. Like once that growl started, I could have imagined all like my brain filled in all those words. I mean, I don't know, or it could have been telepathy. I'm not sure.
Well, you know, I mean, either way, obviously the message would have been loud and clear no matter which way you got it, because I think if something really big is behind you growling, the last thing you want to do is provoke it. I mean, regardless of what it is, if it's a bear or whatever, you just, you don't do anything. You just kind of freeze and you know. So whether the words were actually given to you or whether they're passed on just through the growl and a reaction and a genetic memory or a pheromone or whatever, I think the message is universal on that one. Just don't screw with it.
You know, I've had the same feeling with great white sharks when I was diving or surfing. I've had several run-ins with them. And I never got like a message from them. I mean, like I was definitely like my heart just stops speeding for a second and beats 300 beats a minute, you know, because you're looking at like a school bus with a tail on it swimming around you that could possibly eat you. And you're, you just feel so, I mean, it doesn't matter if you have a knife in your hand, whatever. I mean, these 3,000-4,000 pound sharks just swimming around you. You just, there's nothing you can do. That they want to take it, they can take you just like that. There's not a damn thing you can do. Same thing with a Bigfoot, same kind of feeling.
Yeah. I, you know, the one experience that I've had was very much like that, just the growling part. I'll just paraphrase it quickly because my audience has already heard it dozens of times. But we were hiking down, a friend of mine when I was 14, we're hiking down this ravine, and we got to this spot, and this is in southern Minnesota. And we stopped on this waterfall, and we're just kind of looking at the rest of the hike down. And all of a sudden, there was like something right behind us. And it was above and behind, exactly like you explained it. but it was this deep rumbling growl. And it shook my body. As much as I heard it, it was shaking me. And I was absolutely terrified. Now, I wasn't frozen, but I just knew that whatever that was, I didn't want to see it because it was going to kill me. I mean, that was the only thing going through my head. And I'm 14 years old. I hadn't, as I was telling you before, I had no idea that there was could be a Bigfoot in my neck of the woods. It was where Leonard Nimoy said it was in the Pacific Northwest.
And, right.
But apparently Squatch didn't get that memo because I think he showed up. And you know, I mean, at that point it's fight or flight. Well, I knew whatever made that sound was not something I could fight. So we ended up, finally, my friend and I talked, said, what do you think it is? I don't know. We got to get out of here. So we did. And we left and terror-filled, but we made it down the hill. And for years and years and years, I carried that around with me, not knowing what the hell could have made that sound. Because where I'm from is only white-tailed deer. That's like the biggest thing, you know, and they don't growl. So it wasn't until years and years later, probably 15 years ago, when I started learning about Bigfoot a little bit. And I started watching your guys' shows eventually, too. And that all led me to start to find out about things that people look for. And once I started to look in that same area as an adult, I was like, well, yeah, there's things here that may indicate very well that that was a Sasquatch. And it was just terrifying, but I never did see it. I never did see it, but I couldn't.
Yeah. As far as that infrasound goes too, that night where it was growling behind me, mm-hmm. that first night I had that first encounter.
Yeah.
The lower it got, the more intense the like felt like a laser hitting me coming from it. Yeah. And it actually got to a point where the growl went so low I couldn't hear it audibly anymore, but it was making my whole body vibrate. My tear ducts were wide open and I was hyperventilating. My tears just like more than you could cry, like just pouring out of my eyes.
Wow.
And I was shaking uncontrollably and it was like in slow motion. And yeah, it was super like, and I read about the effects of infrasound. Those were the total effects of infrasound, like headache, dizziness, nauseous, can't breathe.
That's
tears,
incredible.
Tears. Yeah, it was nuts.
Did you notice that effects persisted past that? Because I've heard some people saying, oh, man, you get zapped with infrasound, that'll screw you up for days. Did you notice that, or was that not the case?
Yeah, for 3 days I had crazy goosebumps, like just big, more than you'd see. Like you have to like jump into like a frozen lake for like 10 minutes and get out. Like that was the kind of goosebumps I had for over 72 hours.
Wow. Man, that's freaky. I wonder what it does. I mean, how just this vibration can do that. But it must stun something in us, you know, in our brains or something. It must cause things to work wrong for a while or something.
I think so. I think yeah, infrasound, they can use it as a defensive or offensive weapon.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to ask you this before I do it. I was hoping to catch you before the show, but I'm just glad we got everything going today. Are you open to taking phone calls from listeners?
Sure.
Okay.
Hey, all. It's Don with Paranormal Portal. Just wanted to thank you for joining us for the first part of James Bobo Fay in the Portal. Just want to let you know we will put up part two in just a day or two, so don't miss that. And of course, it is a three-part series, so don't forget, part three will be out shortly after that. Hope you enjoyed, and we're glad you're here. Have a great day.
All right, guys, thank you so much for joining us here on tonight's show. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Please feel free to follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/paranormalportalradio, as well as finding us on Twitter. We're on Twitter at Paranormal Portal, P-O-R-T-L. And we'd love to have you stop by our YouTube page and subscribe and check out our shows there. We got hundreds of shows in our vault of journeys into the paranormal portal. So I hope you'll check it out, guys. We're over there at youtube.com/paranormalportal. So hope to see you guys soon. We'll be back, of course, for more podcasts in the coming days. So stay tuned. But we love you all. Be good, be kind, be nice. Take care of each other. Help each other out. Find the magic in every day and remember to laugh as much as you can. Take care, everybody.